Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. For our listeners on WBAI, normally I do a program and have for 45 years, starting with health and nutrition, environmental issues, a guest of an interesting topic, frequently questions or statements from the audience. But today, because of what's happening in Iraq, in Iran, the disinformation campaign being orchestrated by the Pentagon, the Defense Department, the White House, the State Department, and all the major media, I feel this is very important that we're able to actually deconstruct an entire misinformation campaign that has been wedged between the truth on the one side, held by a minority of individuals, and unfortunately the disinformation on the other side, which is being harped and repeated ad nauseum by virtually everyone in the mainstream media, with one exception. Tucker Carlson over on Fox is the only person on Fox that is not the pro-war and has on a colonel who also has been explaining why we should not be in any of these military engagements and should be removing ourselves from all these countries. What we're going to do now is we're going to begin our program by playing a segment from the PBS NewsHour entitled The Mysterious Death of White Helmet's Co-Founder. Now, they've done some outstanding reporting on their different programs. On this one, however, I take issue. I take issue because they have some highly educated, very capable journalists. Why didn't they get the story accurate? And I'm claiming it is my opinion they did not. So I have no answer for that. I'm not going to speculate. I'm just going to deconstruct and challenge what their journalists are saying. And also for the Hollywood community that has backed the White Helmets, giving them an Academy Award for short documentary, and virtually everyone saying things such as Assad was using chlorine gas bombs dropped from helicopters on his own population, and then that was the so-called line in the sand that Obama and then Trump were going to go after him for. All that can be shown now as being fake, false, and we, the United States, for whatever our motives, and our allies, Saudi Arabia, and that's some ally, and Israel and the United Arab Emirates, were engaged in supporting terrorist organizations, and why the media has refused not even once to challenge them to do an expose on what are we doing fighting a war on cancer when we are supporting the different terrorist groups. So here's what you're going to hear on today's show. First will be their report, then we will start to deconstruct it. We will be playing an interview with Vanessa Bealey, and she will be focusing on who is the real Syrian civil defense or the White Helmets. They're one and the same. And we're going to look at where Syria is currently headed. And she's actually in the war zone. She's in Aleppo. And she is going to go in the very same buildings that the White Helmets were sharing with ISIS and other terrorist organizations. Then you're going to hear from a father of an 11-year-old boy who describes the staged incident by the White Helmets. Now, you can see his photograph, the young boy's photograph, with dust all over his face and supposedly blood coming down from his face, all disheveled, and it was all staged. And the father's explaining why it was staged, who staged it, how it was staged. But we've actually been able to find the same boy in four separate incidents in four different locations, all staged. So why didn't the mainstream media call this out and say, boy, that's in all these articles, it's staged? By the way, there'll be background noise because there's an interpreter interpreting, so please don't be thinking that your broadcast somehow is out of kelter. It's just that you're hearing a background voice and then a voice stating what is being said in English. Then we're going to have something from WikiLeaks, just now released. it releases the OPCW email exchange exposing serious false flag cover-up. The Durans, Alex, is editor-in-chief with Alexander Mercouris, discussed the latest WikiLeaks document release, which reveals that the official organization that's supposed to go in and look at all this, the OPCW officials, were intentionally covering up information from experts on the fact-finding team, which conclusively showed no signs of a chemical weapons attack or chlorine gas exposure in the Douma, Syria community. So this is the first time you're going to hear about this, where the officials who went in, who are recognized by the UN and the United States and all the allies as being the best team, what was released to the public is, yeah, there was chemical exposure and people died, etc. What they actually found and what they stated in their own emails was just the opposite. In fact, you're going to hear where the head of that group was requesting by email that that contradictions be excluded, taken out, covered up. And then we're going to hear from the mainstream media's silence on the OPCW Douma scandal, and then a journalist gagged by Newsweek after the scandalous leak. So that's important. And then WikiLeaks versus the OPCW report, three things that were deleted. A new cache of internal documents reveal that members of the OPCW team tasked with probing the Douma chemical attack protested the organization's final report on the incident. The public was never made aware of this. The media was never made aware of it, which they said misrepresented their conclusions. In a memo addressed to OPCW Director General Fernando Arias, one scientist who participated on the ground there doing the inspection, uncovering the evidence for the OPCW's fact-finding mission, wrote that there was, quote, about 20 inspectors who have expressed concern, end quote, over how the OPCW presented its findings on the alleged Syrian chemical attack. According to the memorandum, the organization's final report does not reflect the findings on the ground presented in their interim report, which is also part of the new documentary document dump. So WikiLeaks got their hands on this. So for the first time, we're going to show you what was behind all this. You're going to hear about the white helmets and who they really are. So if we can find this out with our limited resources, imagine what an organization like CNN or MSNBC or NBC or the New York Times or Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, the Boston Herald, Miami Herald, Boston Globe, and the others, what they could find with whole teams. And yet they didn't. Was it intentional? Negligence? Indifference? Ideology? Self-censoring? What was the motive? I don't know. Now we begin our program, and we're going to segue from one to the other clip so you'll know what you're listening to. The first clip you're going to hear is from PBS NewsHour, an article, The Mysterious Death of White Helmets Co-Founder, and then we'll segue directly in to the other segments, including the interview I had with Vanessa Bealey.
And now a story of a humanitarian trying to help Syria. The suspicious death in Turkey last month of James LeMessurier, the co-founder of the White Helmets Rescue Organization in Syria. Friends and colleagues fear that he may have been murdered or driven to suicide by a campaign of character assassination. Special correspondent Malcolm Brabin has a story and a warning. Viewers may find some of these images distressing.
The body of former British Army officer James LeMessurier was discovered by worshippers outside a mosque in the western part of Istanbul. According to Turkish state television, LeMessurier died from the impact of falling from an upper floor of his apartment. LeMessurier, seen here in 2015, ran a non-profit called Mayday Rescue, which trained members of the White Helmets, also known as Syrian Civil Defense. They are first responders who helped civilians caught in sustained Syrian and Russian airstrikes and were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2016.
In the last 2 years, they've saved over 15,250 lives. People who have literally been dragged from the rubble of buildings that have been blown up inside Syria.
Syria's President Assad was one of the first to express a theory behind Lemessurier's death. He told Russian television that Western intelligence was to blame.
Of course it's the work of the secret intelligence services. But which ones? When we speak of Turkish and some other secret services in our region, these are not secret services of sovereign states. These are subdivisions of the Chief Intelligence Service, the CIA. That is the truth. They're all obeying one master in coordination with each other.
Lemessurier's Swedish wife, Emma, has reportedly told Turkish detectives that her husband was taking medication for stress. Suicide has not been ruled out, but friends and colleagues find it hard to believe that Lemessurier would have intentionally leapt from such a relatively low height.
In the last probably 2 years or so, an awful lot of people who have disagreed with the Russians in particular have fallen off balconies. So I think that it is very suspicious.
Hamish de Breton Gordon is a British Army chemical weapons expert and former colleague of Lemessurier. They last met a month before his death.
I didn't leave that meeting thinking, here is somebody who's really troubled. But having said that, the amount of abuse, the amount of ill-placed propaganda, disinformation that's on social media and the internet, coming out of Russian bots and Syrian regime and others, was unbearable.
Days before his death, on Twitter, the Russian Foreign Ministry accused Lemessurier of being a spy with a history of facilitating terrorist groups, a claim Britain's UN ambassador, Karen Pearce, has vigorously denied. On a hillside at Christmas Common in southern England, Lemessurier was honoured at an art installation commemorating wartime military heroes. The artist, Dan Barton, added white helmets to the silhouettes to pay tribute to the humanitarian work for which the former army captain was decorated by the Queen. The artist was also eulogising the 250 white helmet volunteers killed since they started work in 2014.
James Lemessurier died on Armistice Day when Britain remembers its fallen veterans. Whatever the cause of his death, Lemessurier was the victim of a very modern war. There is no hiding place in cyberspace.
Lemessurier was at the epicentre of a propaganda war, and his friends are appalled at what they regard as a campaign of character assassination.
There must be a decency line, and if you cross that, then something should be done. Some of the stuff coming out of these people, I think, crosses that decency line. Some of the accusing people of being Al-Qaeda, of supporting terrorism.
Vanessa Beely, Vanessa, thanks for coming back on.
De Breton Gordon is most critical of Vanessa Beely, a frequent contributor to Russian media outlets. She belongs to a collection of academics and others calling themselves the Working Group on Syria, Propaganda and Media. This group backs President Assad's claims that the White Helmets have staged attacks to trigger Western retaliation against the Syrian regime. Earlier this year, in Norway, Beely alleged the White Helmets were linked to Al-Qaeda and claimed they were engaged in organ harvesting, charges dismissed by other Middle East experts. She accused Lemessurier of complicity, pointing to his prior role as a UN peacekeeper in former Yugoslavia, where he encountered the Kosovan Liberation Army, the KLA.
The KLA were running organ trafficking operations, cross-border organ trafficking operations, and they were being whitewashed by James Lemessurier, former MI6, who in 2013 set up the White Helmets that are effectively Al-Qaeda, dressed in humanitarian clothing.
Beely is a frequent visitor to Assad's Syria. Via Twitter, I asked whether her attack on Lemessurier could be justified. Her response?
What amazes me consistently is the emphasis from channels like yours on attacking those who raise the issue of such alleged crimes and heinous activity while never investigating the atrocities committed against Syrians, testified to by Syrians. However, you are so quick to condemn the Syrian government based on unverified and fraudulent testimony from the White Helmets. Shameful. Where is your humanity? I stand by every statement.
And when pushed about the consequences of the personal campaign against Lemessurier, this was her reply.
You might seriously consider liability issues if you even remotely suggest publicly that critics of James Lemessurier or the White Helmets are responsible for his demise.
Professor David Miller is another member of the Syria working group to which Beely belongs. It claims the White Helmets faked this 2018 missile attack in Douma, close to Damascus. Up to 50 people were killed and hundreds more, including children, were wounded. Convinced the missiles contained chlorine, the US-led coalition launched airstrikes against Syrian government targets. But Miller's group claims the missile strike was staged to provoke Western retaliation against Damascus and insists it is backed by whistleblowers within the UN specialist watchdog, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons.
The Douma case undermines the investigation into the Douma alleged chemical attack, but it must also throw into question previous reports that have been done. We have written about some of the previous alleged attacks, some of which appear to us to have been fraudulent or faked.
The UN watchdog, whose inspectors are seen here in Damascus, is re-examining the Douma case. But in an email to the NewsHour, the organisation said it stood by the initial impartial assessment that toxic chemicals were used, as does chemical weapons expert Hamish de Breton-Gordon.
I've investigated a number of chemical attacks in Syria in the rebel-held areas, one in particular in 2014 in a place called Talamenes, which is what these Assad useful idiots and Assad is claiming was done by the White Helmets. Now, I didn't see any White Helmets doing anything there. I saw helicopters with Syrian army insignia on them dropping chlorine barrel bombs.
Richard Bennion, who used to sit on Parliament's Intelligence and Defence Committees, says the Syria Working Group are little more than trolls.
There's a much more sinister element, which is very often people from within top academic institutions, universities in the United Kingdom, who are relentlessly pursuing those who support the work of humanitarian organisations like the White Helmets, and relentlessly pursuing a line that supports the actions of one of the most brutal regimes we've seen since Nazi Germany.
What do you think of these criticisms that you are apologists for the Assad regime and also for the Russian comrades in this fight?
I mean, it's ridiculous. The idea that we as lonely academics in the UK writing briefing papers which we put on the web are anything to do with our views on Russia or Syria is preposterous.
As the Turkish inquiry continues, Richard Bennion is calling for a full British investigation into Lemessurier's death and for universities to review the employment of staff involved in this controversy.
The university is employing people who are extremely suspect individuals with disgusting views, where they are prepared to be the apologists for the kind of brutality that we are seeing in Syria. University themselves have got to take responsibility for this.
This is not a question of my views. This is a question of social science research methods and material that we've produced. And if it's, as I say, if it's wrong, then let's show it to be wrong, and let's not have this kind of McCarthyite hysterical witch hunt to try and get academics sacked for simply doing their jobs.
After the body of the White Helmets founder was returned to Britain, his friends lamented that if anyone was subjected to a witch hunt, it was James Lemessurier. Artist Dan Barton.
To me, he's a total hero. The world's going to be a much sadder place without James.
A man who helped save countless Syrian lives, but who couldn't save his own. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant at Christmas Common.
Let's go now to France, where standing by Skype is Vanessa Beely. She is a British investigative journalist. She is focused on the conflicts in the Middle East, particularly in Gaza and Syria. She is an associate editor of 21st Century wire and was a member of a peace-finding mission to Syria and organized by the U.S. Peace Council. Vanessa was in Aleppo during and after its liberation, after the city being captured for almost 5 years by Western United States-backed Salafists, and she is credited with having exposed the fraud behind the faux charitable volunteer organization, the Syrian Defense and Civil Defense, or better known as the White Helmets, which was nominated and then won for a short feature documentary, and today is being promoted on the New York Times front page as if it's this very special and not even controversial organization. Nice to have you with us today, Vanessa.
It's Vanessa, actually, Gary. Thank you very much for asking me on.
Vanessa, I'd like you to focus your energy, please, on concerning the background and the real mission and activities of the Syrian Civil Defense, or the White Helmets. Mm-hmm. Right now, across the United States mainstream media, the volunteers in this organization are being called heroes and the first responders in their efforts to rescue civilians who have been terrorized by the war and conflicts in Syria. And the questions I have are simple. Mm-hmm. Who's being terrorized and by who? ISIS? The United States, NATO-backed Syrian rebel groups such as al-Nusra, or the democratically elected Assad government? And most of these activities that reached international attention were during the siege and violent conflict in the major Syrian city of Aleppo. You were there during the height of the warfare between Russian-supported government forces and the various anti-Assad pro-United States terrorist groups. So please take your time and share what you learned about who inflicted violence upon whom, and who are the White Helmets, who funds them, and why we should be personally outraged at the mainstream media's lauding praise of this organization. The forum is yours.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gary. Well, first of all, I would like to make the point that the Syria Civil Defense is a fraudulent taking of the name of a Syrian state institution that has been in existence since 1953. It was established in 1953. In 1972, it became one of the founding members of the International Civil Defense Organization, whose headquarters are in Geneva and who has clear affiliations with the UN, OCHA, and various other civil defense bodies. That International Civil Defense Organization, though I have had conversations with them, have very clearly stated that they do not recognize the White Helmets as the Syria Civil Defense. And in fact, that explains precisely one of the reasons that the White Helmets were created. They were created primarily by the British government, who has put in the majority funding, followed as a close second by the United States, who have funded them through US aid and through one of their outreach funding sources, Chemonix. They were founded in Turkey, not in Syria, by a British ex-military mercenary, recently given the OBE by the British government, who trained them in Turkey, having previously been involved in various NATO state intervention campaigns, such as Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan. He went to Yemen in 2009. He has worked for and is still working for various euphemistically called private security firms. Among his network, we find the firm of Blackwater, which is famous under the Bush regime for having received an awful lot of money to carry out CIA assassinations to distance the United States administration and the deep state, the CIA, from killings that were being carried out on their behalf. That is extensively documented. Blackwater were then also funded a further $250 million by the Obama administration to continue this good work on behalf of the United States government and the CIA. So that is the area in which the trainer of the White Helmets, James Lemessurier, an ex-British military officer trained at Sandhurst, that's the area that he circulated in prior to coming to Istanbul to set up the White Helmets. He set up the white helmets for three very good reasons. One was to basically disappear the Syrian state institution, the real Syria civil defense, in Western public perception. The real Syria civil defense continues to work in all civilian areas across Syria, not in the terrorist-held areas, but we have to remember that between 80 and 90% of Syrian civilians inside Syria are living in the government-held areas. So the real Syria civil defense services the majority of civilian areas inside Syria. That's a very important point to make. The white helmets were, as I said, created to eradicate the existence of the Syrian state humanitarian first responders in Western public perception. They were then, of course, embedded in what corporate media in the West would call the rebel areas, what we would call the terrorist-controlled areas, controlled predominantly by Nusra Front and ISIS. Those are the only areas that you will find the white helmets. So where the terrorists are, you will find the white helmets. So they were embedded in those areas, so particularly in East Aleppo. From where the white helmets were used to generate the propaganda, the narratives that enabled NATO state regimes, governments, to call for a no-fly zone, which was then reinforced by the corporate media and by the NATO-aligned NGOs, including the UN. So very much the white helmets were created, as I said, just to summarize, to replace the Syrian state institution, to be embedded inside the so-called moderate rebel-held areas, which are effectively the terrorist-held areas, the militant extremists. And then they were there to produce the propaganda that facilitates greater military intervention inside Syria and to facilitate the basically the narrative that maintains the geopolitical strategy in Syria for regime change and to destabilize Syria in order to provide greater security for the US and EU ally in the Middle East, Israel. Coming back to East Aleppo and the liberation, you're quite right. I basically followed in the tracks of the Syrian Arab Army liberation and their allies, liberation of East Aleppo from what was effectively a Nusra Front and assorted around 27 or maybe even more assorted extremist factions, all of them funded by various EU, United States, Gulf States entities who were funding, arming, and equipping these militant factions, who for 4.5 years imprisoned, tortured, abused, violated, kidnapped, executed the Syrian civilians. So for 4.5 years, our corporate media were ramping up the propaganda against, as you say, the elected Syrian government under the humanitarian pretext of protecting and defending the rights of the Syrian people. In effect, what they were doing was actually muting the voices not only of the 110,000 civilians in East Aleppo, Syrian civilians, and amplifying, in fact, in reality, the voices of the terrorist and militant factions. They were also, again, in Western public perception, disappearing and completely erasing the voices of the majority, 1.5 million Syrian people who were living in West Aleppo and who, on an almost daily basis, were coming under attack from hell cannon mortars, which are basically gas cylinders filled with glass, shrapnel, chemical weapons, and explosives, and which were lobbed into West Aleppo. Sniper attacks, suicide bomb attacks, all manner of terrorist atrocities that were committed, as I said, on a daily basis for 4.5 years against the Syrian people, both in East Aleppo and in West Aleppo. 11,000 Syrian civilians, the majority of whom were children, were murdered by these Western-funded extremist factions embedded in East Aleppo, with whom the White Helmets were working closely, participating in these atrocities and facilitating them, supporting them in every way possible. When I spoke to civilians who, as I say, were emerging from this 4.5 year imprisonment, and when I asked them who the White Helmets were, did they know who they were? Had they come across them? Had they rescued any civilians, as they claimed universally for that 4.5 years? Every single one of them told me they didn't know who the White Helmets were, but they knew that there was a paramedic or a civil defense organization that worked exclusively with Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. Some said occasionally they might help civilians, but only if they really had to. The majority of the time they were exclusively supporting the terrorist groups inside East Aleppo. So one wonders, firstly, where these so-called rescue videos were filmed. My suggestion is, if these people who had actually been living alongside these White Helmets, so-called heroes, for 4.5 years, did not even recognize the term White Helmets. So in other words, that suggests that they had never seen these operatives wearing the White Helmets even, but they recognized them as wearing the civil defense uniform, but only working with Nusra Front. That raises many questions about the credibility of the videos that have been produced by the White Helmets, but also the material that has been used in the Netflix documentary and has just been awarded an Oscar, which you know, draws again attention to the fact that effectively what we have seen is corporate media in the West basing their narrative upon testimony from terrorist affiliates for the last 4.5 years in East Aleppo. And by the way, this has just been pretty much confirmed by a recent UN report that came out in the last 48 hours that has confirmed that hospitals were turned into prisons, into ammunition centers, into sniping towers, that schools the same were turned into Sharia courts, into military training centers, the basements were turned into prisons and into torture chambers. All of this I actually saw with my own eyes while I was in East Aleppo. The claim that the Syrian government, the elected Syrian government, was besieging and starving its own people was again another lie. Those who were starving these people were those terrorist factions. Humanitarian aid, both medicine and food, was available in East Aleppo, but it had been stockpiled and it had been kept exclusively for the terrorist and militant factions. The majority of the actual Syrian civilians were starving when they emerged from this 4.5 year imprisonment. They were not treated. They were not medically treated. For many of them, the first medical treatment they received was when they left East Aleppo and came to the Syrian government and Russian-controlled registration center, where they received medical help from the Russian medics who were there waiting for them, who were treating over 150 civilians per day, some of them with injuries that they'd received 4 years ago when the terrorist entities invaded East Aleppo, and they had not been treated during that 4 years. So many of them were coming out actually with limbs that had to be amputated because they had become gangrenous over a period of time of not being treated. So again, you know, this completely exposes the corporate media, our governments, the UN narrative, as being at best horribly misinformed, at worst, complete duplicitous lying in order to further their regime change agenda inside Syria.
Okay. I want to thank you, Vanessa, for your courageous work over there and having the courage to tell the truth, as many journalists do not. And I'm going to invite you back if you have an opportunity to do a whole hour where we can talk about Yemen and the genocide occurring in Yemen by our hidden hand and the Saudis and other people, and also what role Israel has been playing in this since you have been in the territories and you have a different perspective than what the American media is used to sharing when it comes to the so-called only country in the Middle East that's democratic in principle, Israel, and share your points of view. All right?
Yeah, I would love to, Gary. Thank you so much for having me on.
Discussing facts, we have patriots of Syria here with us, and it would be the right thing to do to give the floor to the small boy here, Hassan Diab. He's only 11 years old. You can see him on the White Helmets footage. He's an alleged victim of the chemical attack. But first, we would like to ask his father, Amar Diab, to say a couple of words. And after that, if Hassan wants to say a few words, he will be given an opportunity to do so. Good evening. My name is Amar Hassan. I'm a father of this little boy you can see here. I'd like to speak about the truth of what happened. My children heard the screams that they needed to go to the hospital, so they went to the hospital. They saw fires in the streets, they saw smoke, so they came to the hospital, to the tunnels near our house. In the hospital, some people took my children and brought them to the ambulance, and they started pouring water on them, cold water. Now, because of that, they have suffered, and my wife explained that these children were brought to this hospital without asking their parents. Later we found out that this was a fake. We saw absolutely no evidence of chemical weapon, and all of my family members are feeling well. We were in the basement and we heard people shouting that we needed to go to the hospital, so when we were in the hospital, we went there through the tunnels. At the hospital, they started pouring water on me. The next participant of our talk today, Khalil Al-Jaish, a doctor. He's an expert in resuscitation. Good evening. We came here to inform the world on what happened in Douma, because what happened goes against what was shown in the media and spread through the media, because the video you have seen shows the hospital, the emergency rescue department, and I have been there, I have seen what happened, and what happened was not shown on this video, because on the 7th of April I have been in the hospital. About 7 p.m. we had people coming in as suffering from asphyxiation, but the fact is it was because of smoke, so they had difficulty breathing because of smoke intoxication, and the reason it happened was because nearby building has been bombed, and there was smoke and dust that came inside into the hospital, into the buildings, and in the shelter where people were hiding, people unfortunately inhaled all this dust and smoke, and this is why they had difficulty breathing. So the symptoms of an asphyxiation were relatively mild, moderate, and we did everything that we were supposed to do. We gave them oxygen masks. We proceeded as we always do in such cases. We gave them hydrocortisone. Then a person came, one of the white helmets, and he started shouting that there was a chemical attack, that chemical weapons have been used. And after that, at the emergency care, we saw people creating this hysteria, this chaos in the hospital. They started dousing people with water. We didn't believe these people because we saw no symptoms of chemical attack, chemical intoxication. So there were no evidence of chemical weapons use. All these things, all the people who had suffered from asphyxiation came home later that day. There were no deaths, no people died during that day. And this is the only emergency care in all of Douma.
I'm here with Alexander Mercurius, editor-in-chief of the Duran. Alexander, let's just get right into it. The OPCW, WikiLeaks, has released what they call part 4 of OPCW Douma. I'm going to read you directly from that release, and you can comment right afterwards. Needless to say, The OPCW story is just getting worse and worse for the OPCW. Their lies are being exposed. Here is from WikiLeaks. Today, WikiLeaks releases more internal documents from the OPCW regarding the investigation into the alleged chemical attack in Douma in April 2018. One of the documents is an email exchange dated 27 and 28 February between members of the fact-finding mission, FFM, deployed to Douma, and the senior officials of the OPCW. It includes an email from Sebastian Braja, chief of cabinet at the OPCW, where he instructs that an engineering support from Ian Henderson should be removed from the secure registry of the organization. Quote, please get this document out of DRA, Documents Registry Archive, and please remove all traces, if any, of its delivery, storage, whatever, in DRA. The main finding of Henderson, who inspected the sites in Douma and two cylinders that were found on the site of the alleged attack, was that they were more likely manually placed there than dropped from a plane or helicopter from considerable heights. His findings were omitted from the official final OPCW report on the Douma incident. Alexander.
Right. Perhaps let's just, we've discussed this story several times in several videos now, but let's just remind ourselves what this is, what this is all about. This is about a chemical attack, an alleged chemical attack that supposedly happened in the Syrian town of Douma, which is near Damascus, in 2018. This was a town that was controlled by an Islamic group called Jaish al-Islam, which is a very, very hardline militant group with an ideology very similar to Al-Qaeda. Some say that it has connections to Al-Qaeda. It was in control of this town. The Syrian army placed the town under siege to drive Jaish Islam, Allah's Islam, out. And they did eventually, lay down their arms. Jaish al-Islam did eventually lay down their arms. And the Syrian army marched in and took the place over. Now, just a few hours before this happened, before the Syrian army gained control of Douma, reports appeared on social media and in the international media that there'd been a chemical attack on the town. And we had all the usual pictures and photographs and people looking ill and all the stories that this is another chemical attack. And of course, the Western powers immediately rushed to the conclusion, or said they rushed to the conclusion, that it was the work of the Syrian government. And within a few days of that attack, the United States, Britain, and France launched a series of missile attacks on Syria, purportedly in retaliation for this chemical attack on Douma. Now, what then happened after furious exchanges between the Russians and the Western powers on the Security Council, the UN Security Council, between the Russian ambassador there, Mr. Nebenzia, and the US, was that eventually the OPCW was prevailed upon to send inspectors to Douma to find out what happened. This was after not just the alleged chemical attack itself, but after the US, British, French missile attack. And of course, what happened was that these inspectors then delivered their findings to OPCW headquarters in Vienna. Several months passed. A first report was published by the OPCW, which admitted that there'd be no sarin. Sarin is this deadly chemical that the Syrian military is alleged to have used in earlier attacks in Syria. They found no sarin traces there, but that they did find traces of chlorine. And then several months later, a final report appeared, which said that, in fact, there had been a chlorine attack on Douma. Now, In other words, that there had been a chemical attack on Duma, chemical weapons attack on Duma, and that it had been a chlorine attack, an attack with chlorine, and that these traces of chlorine were attributable to that attack, and that the chlorine came from two canisters, which the report said had been airdropped. The point about them being airdropped is that the only participant in this battle with an air force is the Syrian Air Force. So saying that these canisters were airdropped essentially linked the chemical attack to the Syrian army, the Syrian military, as the US and Britain and France had alleged. Now, what has happened is that over the last few months, that story has absolutely crumbled. And we've heard first, we got a leak of a report by an on-site inspector working for the OPCW, an engineer, a Mr. Ian Henderson, who went to Duma and inspected the canisters and provided a clear report in which he said that the canisters, obviously, it was very difficult to see how the canisters could have been in the position that they were in if they had in fact been airdropped. Almost certainly they had been placed there manually. Now, of course, a manual placement of these canisters clearly points to a fabricated incident. In other words, to an incident that was made to look like a chemical attack, but which wasn't actually a chemical attack at all. And then we've had a string of other leaks from the OPCW, which has made it now fairly clear that it wasn't just Mr. Henderson who was unhappy and who was contradicting the information that the OPCW secretariat was insisting upon, that there'd been a chemical weapons attack, that it had come from the canisters, that the canisters had been dropped by aircraft. It turns out that lots of other inspectors were extremely unhappy, both with the final report and with an interim report that the OPCW prepared, and also with an interim draft report that the OPCW prepared. That an original report prepared by the inspectors cast grave doubts on the entire incident, and that in fact the toxicologists who were part of this part of the inspection team disputed whether there'd been any kind of chlorine attack at all. And they said that the symptoms that the supposed victims had experienced were just not consistent with chlorine poisoning. This is now something that has also come out. And over and above and beyond this, we've also learned that various political people within the secretariat, a British diplomat called Mr. Fairweather, Sebastian Braha, who is a French diplomat. Remember, Britain and France participated in these chemical attacks. He also appears to have been, well, he also was involved. And it turns out that at one point, the inspectors were lectured by unnamed American officials who'd insisted to them that there was, in fact, a chemical attack, even though the inspectors disputed that there was. So what we now have is a further leak via WikiLeaks of internal OPCW documents. And these point the finger directly at Sebastian Braha. This is this French diplomat with a very senior position within the OPCW. And it turns out that what he was up to was that he was trying to suppress, he was trying to destroy, in fact, all trace of this report prepared by Ian Henderson, which said that these canisters from which the chlorine allegedly came from, that these canisters were not dropped by aircraft, but that they were manually positioned on the ground by presumably the Jaish al-Islam or other jihadi groups who were in control of Duma at the time. So we have a situation where the inspection team is saying one thing, the officials at the OPCW headquarters in Vienna are saying are publishing completely contrary findings, contrary to those that the inspectors provided, and that the officials apparently are trying to suppress the information that was coming from the inspectors. So I'm afraid total distortion of the actual findings and a cover-up. There's no other word for it to conceal the fact. A cover-up that goes to the extent of destroying the information from the inspectors that contradicts what is now the official story. I mean, it cannot get more serious than this. It really can't. One wonders how much more we're going to discover. But already, it seems to me, we're looking at an organization in deep crisis.
You took the words right out of my mouth. This is the definition of a cover-up. Remove this information from the documents so that the picture presented to the people, to the world, to be pushed out by the mainstream media was to go to war in Syria, to attack Syria because Assad once again gassed his people. That was the narrative that they were trying to push. The OPCW tried to push us to all-out war. You cannot describe it any other way. You have once again WikiLeaks doing great work. Assange is rotting in prison in the UK right now, but WikiLeaks once again shows us the truth. The OPCW was also involved in the Skripal case, amongst many other investigations that they did. I think now the Skripal case is completely called into question as well. And there's another part of this release from WikiLeaks, Alexander, and I'm going to read you another document that shows more manipulation on the part of the OPCW. And I'm pulling this from Al-Masdar News, which is citing the WikiLeaks press release. Here it is. Another document released today is minutes from a meeting on the 6th of June, 2018, where four staff members of the OPCW had discussions with three toxicologists, clinical pharmacologists, one bioanalytical and toxicological chemist, all specialists in chemical weapons, according to the minutes. The purpose of this meeting was twofold. The first objective was to, quote, solicit expert advice on the value of exhuming suspected victims of the alleged chemical attack in Douma on 7 April 2018, end quote. According to the minutes, the OPCW team was advised by the experts that there would be little use in conducting exhumations. The second point was to, quote, elicit expert opinions from the forensic toxicologists regarding the observed and reported symptoms of the alleged victims, end quote. More specifically, quote, whether the symptoms observed in victims were consistent with exposure to chlorine or other reactive chlorine gas, end quote. According to the minutes leaked today, quote, with respect to the consistency of the observed and reported symptoms of the alleged victims with possible exposure to chlorine gas or similar, the experts were conclusive in their statements that there was no correlation between symptoms and chlorine exposure, end quote. The OPCW team members wrote that the key takeaway message from the meeting was, and I quote, that the symptoms observed were inconsistent with exposure to chlorine and no other obvious candidate chemical causing the symptoms could be identified, end quote.
I don't know about the three little piglets, but the OPCW is having its house blown right down from the inside. The first whistleblower, they dismissed. The second, they sort of excused themselves. And now, in what is an absolute bombshell, their most qualified inspector.
The FFM report does not reflect the views of all team members that deployed to Douma. I found that I was being excluded from the work for reasons not made clear.
Allegedly, the only team member who went to Syria and who was allowed to co-write the Syria report was the team paramedic. None of the chemical inspectors were allowed to pitch in.
I attempted to submit my report to the FFM team leaders, starting from the 15th of February 2019. After noting continued reluctance from the FFM to receive my report, I deposited the report in DRA for collection on the 27th of February 2019 and advised all relevant persons of this.
Shouldn't have bothered. Seems no one wanted to read it. 48 hours later, the OPCW published its first report, and someone had really taken an eraser to it, so much so that the actual team that went to Syria didn't recognize it.
The consensus within the FFM team was that there were indications of serious inconsistencies in findings. The conclusions appear to have been turned completely in the opposite direction.
Now that WikiLeaks has published what the preliminary report looked like, here's what the OPCW deleted. One, evidence that contradicted witness testimony, meaning what the alleged witnesses said differed wildly from the hard evidence found by inspectors. Two, the fact that the hospital videos, which so shocked the world, were fake. The victims or actors displayed symptoms inconsistent with chlorine poisoning or poisoning with anything found at the scene. Three, and this is the big one, in the final report, they found chlorine. Not how much, just chlorine, which you can find in your kitchen, in any home, in any swimming pool.
Maybe you're right. What about then removing trace, or some other wording may work? I'm still worried that a stock standard phrase, such as chlorine-containing compounds were detected, or similar, present the danger of it being misrepresented as a damning conclusion. It's a political wordsmithing situation, not purely technical.
And it was. The anti-Assad war hawks trumpeted the fact. What the OPCW did is akin to saying you found radioactive materials in someone's house, without mentioning it was a tiny amount used in fire alarms. And this, on top of previous whistleblower revelations, hard maths that cast doubt that the canisters at the scene were ever dropped there.
Observations at the scene of the two locations suggest that there is a higher probability that both cylinders were manually placed at those two locations rather than being delivered from aircraft.
It all began with Ian Henderson. When he first blew the whistle, he was mocked, smeared, insulted. The UPCW claimed he wasn't even part of the team. They lied. The leaked documents clearly show he was working for the OPCW.
Shame on the OPCW. You are aware of the highly questionable behaviour surrounding this FFM. We, as others in the team who would like to but are unable, are questioning the work practices followed during this investigation. We are not insisting on being right in our assertions, but we are demanding to be heard. We have been stonewalled throughout by obfuscation, exclusion, and even thuggish and bullying behaviour.
This is more than a rebellion. This is a catastrophe for the OPCW. At best, this is a case of gross negligence. Worst, and I pray I'm wrong, this is corruption. Corruption in the very organisation that's supposed to keep the world safe from chemical weapons. Either way, from now on, when the OPCW says something, people are going to be thinking twice before taking their word for it. A toxicologist, a pharmacologist, and a bioanalytical chemist walk into the OPCW. The OPCW shows them a video of an alleged chemical attack and asks them what sort of symptoms they see. Could they tell what gas it was? The specialists all look at the video and agree on one answer, and the rest is classified. Or was classified.
It was agreed among all present that the key takeaway message from the meeting was that the symptoms observed were inconsistent with exposure to chlorine, and no other obvious candidate chemical causing the symptoms could be identified.
Another day, another leak, another embarrassment, and another blow to the OPCW's credibility. They knew the rebel video was questionable. Didn't find any nerve agent, any chlorine in quantities sufficient to indicate a chemical attack. Nothing. But they wouldn't admit it. We know of at least one person at the OPCW who's very selective about what gets saved and what gets deleted.
Please get this document out of Documents Registry Archive, and please remove all traces, if any, of its delivery, storage, whatever, in Documents Registry Archive.
That was from Sebastian Braha, France's representative to the UPCW. In that email, he demands the deletion of a technical report which concluded that the gas canisters most likely weren't dropped from the air by Assad's aircraft, but placed at the scene, obviously placed by someone, staged.
They tried not just to exclude certain information, but bury it completely, expunge it from their own archive. That is not the scientific method, is it? People don't just bury or delete and actually delete all traces of a report. That is the smoking gun of a cover-up. And now we see the capture and the politicization of the OPCW. What's really encouraging, though, is we have people within the organization that are willing to try and get the truth out.
OPCW is out of its depth here in terms of PR and diplomacy. In the past, they've been a quiet organization. You remember, they even won the Nobel Prize, professionally getting on with their work. But they appear to have been subverted and led astray, if you like. And they've gone into this uncharted waters where now, I think, from a PR perspective, they're finding it difficult to cope. And in the past, if the past three leaks, because this is a fourth leak now of documents, if the past three leaks are a guide, they will, as they've done in the past, simply double down and be in denial, as indeed is the whole, pretty much, of the Western, especially the US-UK media, in not actually investigating or acknowledging the truth that is now actually seeming to be emerging.
There's not enough time to run through everything that the OPCW edited out, every corner they cut, every piece of evidence they twisted to make Assad look guilty, like excluding all but one of their investigators who went to Syria from writing the report, deleting contradictory witness testimony, classifying and keeping secret victims' toxicology reports, bringing in American intelligence agents to lecture chemists, 24 employees suspected unprofessionalism, fraud or even foul play, according to leaked emails. But the boss, he stuck to his guns.
While some of these diverse views continue to circulate in certain public discussion fora, I would like to reiterate that I stand by the impartial and professional conclusions reached by the fight-finding mission.
You know who disagrees with him? The first Director General of the OPCW, who has co-signed an open letter calling on the organization to let people who they've gagged speak out. With every leak, the story gets bigger, more scandalous, which may not be the impression you get on TV or in the big papers. It's all OPCW defends its report and hits back at whistleblowers. Many of the people writing these, they're scared. There's only so much that they're allowed to write.
Many editors and many journalists aren't even aware of the propaganda. So what will take place is they'll be told, oh no, this is all just rubbish. Look at this Bellingcat article. And maybe some that are aware that they are dubious and they're not to be trusted. I think there's probably too much risk involved in them for them to say, listen, we shouldn't be trusting them. You know, what I showed that took place at Newsweek, I think takes place at many organizations where you've got editors and, you know, possibly senior reporters where, you know, they go and work in these think tanks that are related, you know, that they're cultivating relationships with US State Department officials or heads of different political organizations. And I think what that starts to do is it becomes a conflict of interest.
This is the new OPCW. It is no longer about finding the truth, establishing what happened molecule by molecule. Now it picks which molecule to show and which to hide. Now the OPCW synthesizes chemical guilt, literally, out of thin air.
We've asked the OPCW to confirm whether or not the latest revelations are indeed true. So far, they have not responded.
Award-winning journalists on the scene, communicating with no agenda except seeking the truth. That's what you've heard. And I believe that we should all offer an opportunity for PBS, this NewsHour, to examine our evidence and then see if they have not been remiss in how their report was put together and see if they wish to amend, change, add on anything in their original report. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour.
watched too many of you cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die.